So the doctor offered to give the sisters...
The sisters, yeah, medical exams.
Okay.
Because he was concerned that they should, you know, be well. And I, but of course, no one was really interested in doing this either, so I got sent to the doctor to have the medical exam. I was sort of sent off when anybody wanted...
But is that because you were one of the youngest?
Yeah. Right. It was kind of like, well, you go. We don't want to say we're not interested,
right.
So we'll just start with the youngest. Say you go and, you know. But he was very involved with Cesar Chavez, and he went and gave his services in Delano for the farm workers, too.
Mm-hmm.
So through him, I heard about the march and the fact that they were inviting people from California, well, from anywhere, who would go on the weekend or something and join the farm workers on their march to Sacramento.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, wouldn't it be wonderful if some of the sisters went? Well, I thought, oh, great, that would be terrific. You know, go out there and show your support. So I went home and said, well, you know, can I go on the march? And my superior was like, well, I don't think so. You know, you're not going out and wearing the habit and sort of into the streets. And this was sort of the 60s when should sisters march for civil rights? Should they march for farm workers? You know, or would we separate and
yeah.
call political? Should women at women religious be? So I was like, so she said to me, well, you can't, you need a companion, because that was also the rule. Sisters needed a companion when they went out.
Another sister.
They didn't go out alone. So, and that was kind of like, I think that was like, that'll be the end of it because no one will go. But I talked one of the other sisters into going with me. So I said, I have a companion. Now can I go? You know, well, she said, you need transportation. So then I had to talk to Dr. Jared Ackner about, well, can I, you know, is somebody going that could pick us up? And, you know, and yes, he said, so this young man and with his daughter, who had a, they were going to join the march. So he could pick us up and take us. So we went with him, and then we were going overnight. It was, I don't know, I'm trying to remember which towns we walked to.
I think I read the article that, or
that
the article
wrote,
you wrote. I think you were around Modesto, maybe?
Right, Modesto, Mantino, Stockton, it was
yeah.
those towns. Anyway, we had to stay overnight, because the march was like marching one day and stay overnight and then march the next day. So then came, and it was also an experience. There were people shouting at us because we were wearing habits.
Right.
We were very noticeable and we were condemned for, you know, being out in public and so that made me, of course, feel very saintly.
Now, they were shouting at you because did they feel you represented the Catholic Church? Or
yeah.
Yeah, and they didn't think that...
Well, and also that as nuns, it was a disgrace for us to be out, but it was also not appropriate for us to be with these people.
Okay.
It was kind of, we shouldn't be supporting this cause. So they were opposed to the farm workers and certainly opposed to, obviously, representative Catholics. I mean, we were not representing the Catholic Church, in fact, but because we... were dressed as nuns, everyone assumed
you were easily identifiable.
Right, and so it looked as if there was an official sponsorship, when in fact, I mean, it wasn't, but that's the thing about wearing a habit. You,
yeah.
You know. So anyway, we and then we end up in, it seems like it was Mantino that night, and of course, I mean, after that long walk, we just collapsed in the park, and then we were told there was a threat against the sisters. And so the organizers of the march were like, if you want to get up and go out of the park, you know, we will accompany you, we will protect you from this threat. And it was kind of like, we do not want to walk anywhere, you know.
Yeah.
We're happy to stay in the park and not walk. But the interesting thing, another issue about boundaries was the young man and his young daughter that had given us a ride were in the park, and then we had to... the arrangements for the night were we were all going to sleep in the school. It was a Catholic school. And use the washrooms and stuff, you know. Well, then we get this messenger comes to us and says, you know, that the two of us are invited to go and stay in the convent. And that was another boundary issue for me. So I said, well, can this man and his daughter, who accompanied us, also stay in the convent? I mean, they didn't accompany us, we accompanied them.
Right.
Can they also stay in the convent because we're together? No, no, they can't. So it was like, well, okay, then we'll stay in the school.
So we're with them.
Yeah, we're with them. We're with this march.
Right.
And if everybody can't stay in the convent, then we're not going to go and stay in the convent. You know, it's not open to everyone. So, again, it was that idea of, I mean, I kind of understand why everyone couldn't stay in the convent, but even these people that had brought us.
Right.
And it was once again this boundary of, this is what we represent, but actually we're pretty exclusive because we
right.
have all these rules.
And do you think that you didn't, this became more visible to you in California because you were sort of juxtaposed between the secular and the religious communities?
I'm sure that's true, but yes, I'm sure it is true. I'm sure that if I had just been teaching in a high school and living in a convent, I wouldn't have had as many moments of encountering these questions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were, I wasn't the only one who was raising them. I mean, people were experiencing them. But especially those of us who were sent to graduate school did encounter a lot of these boundary issues about our world and the world we were part of. And so for me, that idea. The other thing that happened to me on that march is the evening program in the park was all in Spanish, and I didn't speak Spanish. And I had this sort of dawning awareness that, of course, I was a graduate student at Stanford who thought I was so smart and I was really going to make a brilliant contribution to the world. And here I am sitting in this park, I can't even understand the program. And I'm of no use to these people because I don't speak Spanish. So
right.
that whole sense of how, you know, you think you're so smart, but what good is this smart in this context? So it was kind of like, sometimes, you know, you have to, your contribution is not this intellectual or educational. In this case, putting your body on the line is what matters, not what's in your, I mean, what's in your head, yes, because you're committed, but not what you know about medieval history.
Right,
doesn't matter.
Your physical presence means
right.
more. Right.
So that awareness of how, you know, yes, the intellectual world is important, but there, life is much larger than that, and action and commitment and presence matters a lot, you know. So that whole integration of the person and the sense of what that I really learned
from that experience.
Encounter with, you know, Jerry Lackner as the doctor who was very committed, and the political programs about social justice, and then the movement of Cesar Chavez and walking with that, and in relation to being at Stanford. I mean, it was just a really transforming experience.
Well, and how did you carry that back with you into the order then? Did that sort of come with you, and were you able to
right,
play
when
that
I came
out?
Back to Mundelein, and after I finished my master's degree, I was teaching history, and then again, a lot of the younger people were assigned to live in the dorms.
The younger sisters?
My younger sisters,
okay.
Yeah. So I lived in the Northland dorm, and there were four or five of us who lived there, so, you know, we were a lot closer to the students in the sense than, because we weren't that far apart in age,
mm-hmm.
And we were interested in their lives, and then we also were associated with one another, so as younger members of the community, and we had all these wonderful discussions about, because by this time, the Second Vatican Council is on now. It's 66 when I came back.
When you came to Mundelein.
Right.
Okay.
And the Second Vatican Council was on, and Mundelein had wonderful programs of theologians, and Carol Francis Jagan was teaching all the most recent theology. And so we had a good education, but then when we were part of the faculty, and we were still quite excited about all these new ideas, and the, mm-hmm. And that was also the end of the institutional analysis at Mundelein, where the basic studies program was put in, and the term system was put in, and so the curriculum had all been changed.
Okay.
And there was a lot of work on, you know, how are we going to make this work for the core curriculum and the other studies. And the institutional analysis had opened up all these questions about what is a women's college and the whole women's movement. And so there was a lot of commitment to equality for women as well, even mm-hmm. though it wasn't. Because, so that was, you know, from farm workers to equality for women, to
social
civil
justice
rights, to,
right.
And then, of course, there was the protest against the Vietnam War. So all those things mixed together in terms of my commitments and participation as a citizen.
Mm-hmm.
And so marching for the ERA, marching to protest the war, I mean, you know, the idea of going into the streets and joining other citizens in protesting was something that then, you know, I carried on. And very sadly, after the, it was in the spring before the Democratic Convention in 68, and it was a march, actually it was a march in, I think it was a women's rights march. It was a march in support of the ERA. Although that, I maybe it was a protest march for Vietnam. Now I can't really remember, but anyway, it was in April, and a lot of students went, and some faculty went, and we were marching through Grand Park, and then we were going to end up at the Daley Plaza, or the Federal Building.
Yeah.
And I was there, but I had visitors from out of town. So rather than going all the way into the to the Federal Building Plaza, we sort of cut out and took the L back up north because, you know, it was like, well, we needed to get back. And the students went on to the Federal Plaza, and of course then the police dispersed everybody, and they it was sort of a prelude of the Democratic Convention.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a student who was came back and had been hit by the police truncheon, and I had to take her to the emergency room that night.
Yeah.
And so then that became an issue on the campus about how can you trust the police if when you go to march and
in
know,
a peaceful
express
demonstration.
Yourself mm-hmm. as a citizen, you get attacked by those who are supposed to be the law enforcement. So then we had to have discussions with students about, you know, legitimate authority and rightful authority and abuse of authority, and we had the aldermen come and talk about, you know, what is citizenship, and if, you know. And that, of course, was for the students as well as for us, this painful education in the idea of, you know, the rights of citizens, but really how free are you? And of course, it was also an awareness of privilege in the sense that I had been not so aware of in marching with the farm workers, but, and you know, the civil rights movement and the abuse of the marchers in the South by the police. But here, now it was in Chicago, and suddenly, you know, middle-class white people were the ones who were confronting the police. And we had always been brought up that, you know, the police are your friends.
Right.
So it was a real shock.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had to work through this with the students. And so all kinds of questions of authority and integrity came up. And it was a wonderful experience because it was, in all of that education, was always a challenge to your values,
mm-hmm.
you know, to
as
really try to practice what you're committed to and the realization that it's hard to do.
And do you mean your values as a person or as a member of a religious
vocation? Well,
both.
I mean, I think that the religious vocation is to follow the example of Christ in living for others. So, I mean, you know, it's not different from people who aren't members of a religious community, mm-hmm. but it's supposedly a sort of more complete effort or something. That's another strange boundary, which it's a form of living a Christian life that really isn't that different from anybody else's Christian commitment. So in that sense, it's mm-hmm. not distinct that you were a member of a religious community.
Okay.
That's just a way of being a Christian in a certain group with certain
yeah.
commitments.
Okay.
But married people make their, single people make their commitments, mm-hmm. and they're all out of the same baptism and the same sense of faith, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that was also an awareness that being a member of a religious community didn't make you special or superior, which was a kind of attitude that is still about.
Right.
It was a way of leading a Christian life. Not necessarily a better way.
Right, or the only way.
Or the only way. But okay. It was a way that was a legitimate choice that people could make, and then you should honor it. But it wasn't like, you know, you're better than other people.
So let's sort of switch gears a little and talk about your doctoral studies. When you were at Mundelein teaching, when you came back in the late 60s, were you already planning on pursuing a PhD, or was it something that came to you later?
Yes, actually, I had asked about staying on at Stanford. Because one of the things I realized is, you know, once you're in the groove, you kind of want to keep going. And but I was told, no, I should do something, you know, practical and not just be in school forever. So I should go and, you know, use this master's degree and then go later. So I went back and I taught for 3 years at Mundelein. This is from 66 to 69.
Okay.
And the other thing that happened in those years is, so I lived in the residence hall for a year, maybe 2 years. And then, as again, a result of changes in the community, it was okay. Well, first of all, we changed out of the habit, so we weren't distinctive anymore, which was one of these, you know, we're not really better than other people. So we changed out of the habit, and then we could live in apartments, not on campus or
okay.
in condos. So then a group of us moved to live in an apartment on Pratt.
Uh-huh.
So again, you know, I mean, this is all very, everything is new and experimental. And so then the last year, I think, I walked to school from this apartment on Pratt. And then in 69, I was kind of like, well, I was 30, I guess. So it was like, if I'm going to go back to school, I should go. So I applied, and I applied to Wisconsin, Michigan, and Illinois, I think. And I got money from Illinois,
okay.
So I went to Illinois. And that was a good program. I mean, I remember thinking it was kind of like going to the cornfield. So I was like, what is a urban Catholic going to do
in the middle of Illinois?
Illinois. Yeah. But, and it was kind of interesting because it was very, you know, there were still blue laws in Urbana, I think, in one of the towns, Champaign or Urbana, I'm not sure which. And the parties that were held, you know, we had, they were like Protestant church suppers, the faculty parties. We had seafoam jello, turkey slices, and lemonade. And I was like, ooh, where is the whiskey? This is a different cultural environment than I was used to. So that was sort of interesting, you know. But it was a good education. And then I also had the idea of going to England, because I was doing British history, so it was kind of like, you know, a couple years in the cornfields if I can then go to England. So I got a Fulbright.
And that was 1971?
Yeah, 71.
Okay.
And my mother was very sick. She had colon cancer. But she was very thrilled that I got the Fulbright and I was going to England. So I went off and then and got settled. I had to figure out what county I was going to study. I was going to study this county government reform. And so I traveled around. I bought an old used car and I drove around and visited different local history offices. And then I decided on Kent because it was a well-organized archive and it wasn't as well studied. I didn't know at the time that it's because it's not a typical county.
Oh.
So it was, but that was all right because by the time I was studying it, it was more like other counties, but its history had been quite different. Anyway, I was there, but then, and again, I did have this experience of, you know, being really alone because I knew people who were in London, but I wasn't in London. I was going off to this archive, you know, without knowing anybody. At least people spoke English, but...
Yeah, and then, so where did you stay? Did you just
I stayed in digs, as they're called. I stayed in a room in a woman's house.
Okay.
And I had kitchen privileges, so I, you know, no refrigerator. And I could cook a meal and, you know, had a little cupboard where I could keep some food. And I had a room... use the bath. But then one of the things I did, which again was American experience, was she didn't have a telephone. So I had a telephone installed in her house.
Oh.
Because I didn't want to be totally out of touch. And as actually my family wanted that too because my mother was so ill.
Mm-hmm.
So then I flew home in January. To see her because she had a sort of, it seemed like maybe she was going to not make it. But she recovered, so then I went back. And then I was working, and in May, then I got another call to say, you know, they thought that was probably she was going to die. So then I went back again to Hammond, and I must have come back about the middle of May. She died on the 30th of May, and then I stayed until the middle of June because I was helping my father kind of get settled after that. And then I went back. And when I went back, I got a renewal of the Fulbright.
Okay.
For a second year. And then one of the archivists that I met at the Kent Archives, and we had talked about trying to find a flat or some place to live because she also was living in digs in a mm-hmm. person's house. And she did find a flat. So I came back to live in a flat. And again, this was such a gorgeous place, a village called Cobham. And, you know, it was three pubs and a church with English brasses and an almshouse, charity house, and a medieval hall. And we lived in the Tudor section of a farmhouse, which had an 18th century attachment. And, you know, it was just a picturesque English
yes.
village. So there I am. You know, driving around this beautiful county, looking at where all these county councilors lived and living in this very picturesque place. And then that year was much easier because then I also met a lot of young English people who were friends of Jackie Rose and kind of got much more of a sense of English culture. Although
and Jackie was the one
Jackie
you
Rose
shared?
Was the archivist,
oh, the archivist
that I shared the flat
okay.
with, yeah. And we, you know, are still friends. But one of the interesting things about that in terms of boundaries or identity was that they were, well, it was, you know, American tourists and Americanization was sort of, you know, they were not fans of that. So it was sort of, I was accepted and I was the exception. I wasn't American, but I wasn't like an American. So then I had that identity sense of, but I am American.
Right.
This is what Americans are like, not just, you know, as well as like anybody else you want to say. But so that English sense of kind of xenophobia, you know, we will sort of allow you to be like us. And I had such a different experience in Scotland where the Scots would say, "Oh, you're an American. You're not, you know, you're not Scots. Well, sit down and tell us all about America now. You know, we don't know about it. We'll tell you about Scotland." There was this acknowledgement of difference, which was then very warmly received. Whereas in England, there was sort of a denial of difference, which was much less welcoming.
And
it's an interesting phenomenon.
That is interesting.
You know.
And did the fact that you were a BVM influence their acceptance?
Well, I wasn't wearing
or?
A habit. And
okay.
Being a Catholic was a little bit of a problem. But again, that was sort of like, well, by that time, the idea of being Catholic wasn't quite such a shock. I mean, it was a little more ecumenism. And of course, there was more ecumenism on the Catholic side, too. So that wasn't as controversial.
Mm-hmm.
I think probably being American was even more important than being
so.
Catholic. But I did have this experience with my landlady when I was living in Diggs. Her father had been in World War I and had come back and was unemployed, so was sent to Ireland as a black and tan. And of course, I was Irish. I mean, I was American, but of Irish extraction. So this woman talked about how horrible the Irish were and how her father was not allowed to take her and her mother because the Irish were such animals and were so awful. And that also was kind of like, well, what is this about, you know?
Yeah.
Your, you know, ancestors created such a situation that my ancestors had to go to the United States. And now I'm coming back studying your country and putting a phone in your house and you're telling me that the Irish are animals and can't be trusted, you know? It was this strange world of perceptions and positions. So I guess just so anyway, I did this study of local government and got my PhD. And I actually came back to Mundelein in 74. Again, I mean, this wonderful privilege compared to what many graduate students have to endure. I had a year to write my dissertation.
Oh, wow. That's
so, you know, it's funded. So I finished, and then I finished in 75, in January. And then I was teaching. I started teaching in the fall of 74.
While
you were
still...
73, 74,
okay.
But I was just finishing up, and then... and that was the year Weekend College started.
Okay, and were you involved with Weekend College?
I wasn't involved in the first semester, but in the second semester I was in teaching strategies. And that was this whole rethinking of what it meant to organize a course and how to teach at the college level in a different framework, in a different time frame to adult students. And we had workshops and we had experts come and talk about adult pedagogy, we had to rethink because we had this commitment to the quality of the courses, but you were teaching an upper division history course and you were only going to meet the students 5 times in 10 weeks. How did you have to think about the materials they had to read on their own and what they had to do with those materials so that when you all came together you could use your time well? And you certainly couldn't be talking to them for 3 hours when, you know. So you had to really figure out how to engage in a discussion with the students to get at the issues and not just be lecturing.
Yeah.
So it was a transformation in understanding how to teach.
I'm going to switch the tape before
okay.
It runs out and then we...